Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're live again for an hour, as is the case, generally speaking, on weekday afternoons. The live format of this program enables us to be interactive in real time, you by way of telephone and me by way of a radio transmitter. We can talk back and forth. Now, why would anyone want to do that? Why engage in conversation with a stranger on the radio? Well, if you can't think of any good answers to that question, then probably you won't. And that's okay, too. You're not under obligation to call. But some people have questions about the Bible and about the Christian faith that they'd like to discuss with somebody who invites discussion on those things. And frankly, some people may have heard this host say things in the past that they think are simply untrue or irresponsible or mistaken, and would like to bring correction or balance. If that is the case with you, if any of those things are the case with you, feel free to give me a call. We have some lines open right now. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is John, calling from Corvallis, Oregon. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hey, I've listened to your positions on things like age of the earth or mankind and things like that. And I wondered, because I've used an argument or had thoughts myself in regard to this, and I wonder if you've ever come across somebody's response to it. And it has to do basically just the idea that people who claim that, you know, man is, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years on the planet, and yet it seems that all of the evidence that we have, at least historically, from civilizations and recorded history and things like that, shows it to sort of be what people have recorded more in the 5 to 10,000 year range. We don't have any examples of, you know, people and civilizations recording history 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 years ago.
That is what I understand the evidence to support also.
Which is, you know, it's kind of an anecdotal argument for man maybe not being here as long. I wonder if you've ever heard anybody's, or had heard any response from people who take an old universe, old, you know, mankind being on the earth a longer period and to that.
I don't know that I could speak for them about that, but I think I have some idea of what they might say. And so if I put on my old universe hat for the moment and try to answer like somebody from that camp, I would probably say that although man evolved and emerged from ape-like ancestors perhaps a million years ago, he did not learn how to write. He did not learn how to organize his societies. He did not learn how to make artifacts that we could find today, make monuments and so forth, until much more recently, that the early hundreds of thousands of years of man's existence were not characterized by the kinds of activities that would leave their mark for us to discover. And therefore, it wasn't until people, for example, began to build cities or to learn how to write and leave documents or at least etchings on stones or whatever, that we would begin to find evidence of their of their existence. And that only happened in the 5 to 10,000 years ago. Now, this is not my position,
right,
but this is what I would expect them to say.
Yeah, which I find kind of interesting because, you know, it seems then that, you know, you'd have all this dead period of lack of development, and then 5, 6, 7,000, whatever you want to put it, you have this tremendous sort of explosion of you know.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that's a good point because certainly if man has been around for a million years, then the last 6,000 years has been a mere blip on the timeline,
right.
And yet if a mere 6,000 years ago people learned how to read and write, and now they send rockets into outer space and they do brain surgery and things like that, you'd have to say, boy, that was a pretty rapid uptick, a spike in development. And one wonders, why were there 994,000 years of human existence on Earth without any, without even the beginnings of that kind of sophistication? I mean, it doesn't seem like a slow and gradual evolution, does it?
No, it really doesn't. So, yeah, I wanted to throw that out. I appreciate your analysis in regards to these particular issues, and I've never really had a I've thrown it out there to friends of mine who are, you know, unbelievers and ardent evolutionists, and I've never really gotten a response in regards to that. So anyway, I just thought I would see if you'd ever spoken with anybody.
I honestly don't remember having heard had that particular discussion with people arguing for the older. The earlier appearance of man on Earth, but I think it's worthy of note. I think you have a good point. I'm not sure exactly what they would say, but I think they would say something like what I represented. All right. Well, sounds like we got cut off. I didn't hang up. Maybe he did, or maybe we just got cut off. So. We're done with that call with John in Corvallis, and we have lines open for you if you'd like to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to call the program with any kind of question or with a difference of opinion that you'd like to defend. Feel free to do that. I've received a number of questions by email in the last few weeks that I have not had time to get to on the air, and I usually wait until there are no calls to take these kinds of questions on the air. Right now there are no calls. All the lines are open, so feel free to occupy it by calling 1-800-438-5090, and I'm going to talk about some of these questions that have been written in. One of them came from Butch in New Jersey. Now, Butch has been listening for about 15 years or so, I think, on this program, if I'm not mistaken. He used to call. I haven't heard from him for a very long time. That is, I haven't heard any calls from him for a long time, and I hadn't even heard anything by other media or methods for a long time. But I just got this email from him the other day, and he said, Steve, what are your thoughts on true revival, please? Do you believe it is the reviving of the body of Christ, or do you think it means non-Christians being born again? Can you give a few examples from past revivals, especially the Jesus movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s? Thanks. Well, Butch, what you're asking is for really kind of a refinement of a definition of the word revival. And by the way, the term revival is not really found in the Bible. The phenomenon of people turning to God suddenly and in large numbers is found in the Bible. Sometimes this is a revitalization of the faith of God's existing people, Israel, in the Old Testament, as, for example, in the days of Josiah. And other times, it's simply an influx of converts into the church, such as we find it on the day of Pentecost. Now, both of these are sometimes called revivals. Technically, the word revive suggests something has died and has been brought back to life. And therefore, many people would use revival to speak of a renewing of the zeal and the spirituality of the church, a church that has already, known God, Christians who have been Christians already but who have been somewhat dead and lackluster and lethargic in their faith. And who suddenly spring to life and become excited about their faith. But many people begin to think of a revival as a time when a lot of people are converted. And I don't know if you can have a revival without both of those things happening. It seems to me once Christians really begin to take their faith seriously, begin to act like God really is real, of course he is, but we don't always act like it. Once we begin to live the way we say we believe, it does have an impact on evangelism. It does tend to make our faith credible to outsiders and leads to people being converted. So that when you see the church inwardly revived, generally speaking, you're going to see more people converted as well. So the revival will have, both effects. You can't really pin it down to just, Christians getting excited about God or just a lot of people being saved at one time. Like I said, if the Christians get revived, there will be more conversions. On the other hand, if there begin to be a lot more conversions, that will tend to get the Christians more excited as well. Frankly, we're living in a dry spell, I believe, in this country spiritually. We've got all kinds of churches and TV and radio Christianity, but we really don't have a very large percentage of the people who attend church really taking Jesus seriously in their lives day by day, moment by moment, in their marriages, in the way they spend their money, in the way they entertain themselves. It's very clear that Jesus is sort of a peripheral in their life, and he's not the center of their lives in many cases. And that is, I think, particularly discouraging at this present time. And we don't see a lot of people converted either, come to think of it. Now, I do believe if we began to see some of our friends coming to Christ in large numbers, we'd perk up. On the other hand, if we would perk up, maybe our friends would take Christ seriously and say, hey, if it means something, if it really means this much to you, maybe I should take a look at it more carefully, more objectively. I just don't think you're going to see a revival where only one of these two things is happening. I think that when God begins to part his spirit, both things happen. Now, you mentioned the Jesus movement in the late 60s and early 70s. I was a part of that. I was not converted in the Jesus movement because I was already a Christian. I was a Baptist growing up, and I had come to faith as a child, and I've been baptized at age 12 and so forth. And all of this was before the Jesus movement. I was actually preaching in junior high school, and I was not going to a Christian school. I was going to a secular school. So I was actually taking a stand for Christ before the Jesus movement began. But I was about 16 at the beginning of the Jesus movement and had the good fortune or the blessing of being taken to the hub of the movement, which at that time was Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. And I saw people getting saved, lots of people getting saved, lots of hippies, lots of young people coming to Christ, at least seemed like 50 or more every night of the week. And typically about 1,000 a month were baptized. And that was a pretty big influx. That's kind of like a revival, certainly. And it revived me in a different way, too, because I was seeing the power of God to harvest the disenchanted youth into his kingdom and to change their lives and to deliver them from drugs and to work supernatural works. And I had never seen those kinds of things in my lifetime in the Baptist church, and it tended to cause me to take my faith more seriously and to be revived. So, I would say Jesus movement was a revival like most in that respect, that lots of people got saved in a short period of time, and people who were already saved, people like myself at the time, really had a revitalization of our own existing Christian faith. Well, now our lines are full, so I'm going to talk to some of these callers. The first is Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Brad, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I was wondering if you've ever looked at the conflict, the bloody conflict between Luther and the Anabaptists from Luther's perspective. Luther's, instead of the idea that what the Anabaptists come up with, that they were being persecuted by Luther because of rebaptism.
Well, no, I've never actually seen it from Luther's side. I've seen it from Zwingli's side because he actually was the one, the Anabaptists arose on his watch in Switzerland. But the Luther and Calvin and other reformers also had negative things to say about them. But go ahead and share with us what you're talking about.
Well, I don't think that Luther ever wanted to hurt an Anabaptist for a theological difference, especially specifically rebaptism, based on Luther's own words, based on some reading that I read from an Anabaptist historian. Luther was irritated with Anabaptists specifically because of the peasant revolt. So I just think it's important to understand that, because I think it discredits Christianity in general, but Martin Luther specifically, to say that he persecuted and murdered Anabaptists simply because of a theological difference.
Well, you may be right, because I don't hear as much about Luther's response to Anabaptists as I do about Zwingli and Calvin's. Calvin wrote a treatise against the Anabaptists, and Zwingli himself authorized the killing of 4,000 Anabaptists in Switzerland, and that was because they got rebaptized. Now, what Luther's position may have been, I'm not sure. I've never read his position.
Exactly. See, what's so funny to me about that is everybody will bring up Luther first, and I think it's because he's an easier name to remember. So it kind of saddens me to see that Luther gets the blame of something he didn't do.
And I think the reason people bring Luther up first is, like you said, he's the better known name than Zwingli, but also because he was the first of the reformers in the 16th century, and the Reformation as a whole took a dim view of the Anabaptist movement. Some of the reformers were more violently opposed to them. Some only verbally attacked them.
Right. Now, why do you think that is, though? I mean, I was wondering. See, that's exactly what I'm thinking. So I'm saying, okay, as a balanced and honest historian, you know, or a guy who wants to know the history, because that's my Christian duty, correctly, not, I don't want to believe lies. I'm saying, okay, from their perspective, why do they dislike the Anabaptists so much? And when I do that, when I go and read the Anabaptists and even Martin Luther's, it's totally different than what I get from the modern people who just spout out how bad Luther was. It was specifically that Luther was the first to really succeed in the Reformation, and he knew that success would not happen if lawless, crazy rebellion just engulfed the entire Germanic area. And Luther was trying to explain to the Anabaptists, you've got to go slower. You can't, because a bunch of the peasants were just crazily destroying everything and killing people and calling themselves Anabaptists. And all Luther was trying to do was calm everybody down. It was like Satan put everybody on fire right after Luther's Reformation. And he was like, if this thing just goes crazy, we're going to lose. And so Luther was trying to tell the Anabaptists, just calm down. And the Anabaptists are saying, we're not doing it. The crazy peasants are claiming to be Anabaptists.
Well, that's just it. The true Anabaptists would not kill anyone. They were anti all forms of violence. Yeah.
So what was happening was the peasants were claiming to be Anabaptists, and they were wrecking havoc. They were killing. They were destroying buildings. And they were saying, well, we're Anabaptists. We're taking the Reformation even further than Martin Luther has enough courage to do. And Martin Luther's like, we're going to lose if we do it this way. And so it ended up being a physical war. And Luther took the side of civility, of civilization. And the Anabaptists got the blame for the anarchy. And every once in a while I read an Anabaptist who acknowledges that. But most Anabaptist historians say that Luther attacked them because he didn't agree with their theology, and it's not true, according to even Luther's own writings.
Okay.
But I thought I'd say it because you mentioned that last week. You mentioned Luther again last week, you yourself, as being one who persecuted the Anabaptists. So that's why I called.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Okay, Brad. Bye now. Okay, Terrell from Everett, Washington is next. Terrell, welcome to The Narrow Path.
How you doing, Steve?
Good.
Hey, I just got a question. I'll take your answer off air. I've been reading in Genesis 19, in verse 12. And verse 12 talk about Lot's children. And I never noticed it until now that It talks about his son-in-law and his sons. Did he have sons? I'll take your answer off air.
Sorry, which verse are you looking at?
Genesis 19 and 12.
Verse 12. Okay, I'll talk about
it. All right, thanks.
Okay, I appreciate your call, Terrell. Bye now. All right, the verse says the angel spoke to Lot when the angels were trying to persuade Lot to leave Sodom because it was going to be destroyed. And so they're asking him, you know, they say, have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. Now, he may have had sons. They're really not telling him what he has. They're asking him what he has. Do you have, sons-in-law? Do you have sons? Do you have daughters? Do you have anyone in this city? Get them out of this place. Now, it would seem that since these were angels, they would not be uninformed as to, you know, whether Lot had sons or not. And one might argue, therefore, that this suggests he did have sons. We know he had sons-in-law because we know that Lot went to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, it says, and tried to persuade them to leave, and they didn't take him seriously. It doesn't say he went to his sons, and therefore maybe he didn't have them. And if we would say, well, then why did the angels even suggest that as a possibility? I guess we'd have to say that angels are not God. Angels themselves are not omniscient, and therefore they knew what their mission was. They knew what they were to tell him as far as that he had to get out of town and that he could save anyone he wanted to who'd go with him. But apparently they were not given full information about how many family members he had. I guess angels, what angels are informed of is perhaps on a need-to-know basis. You know, in God's economy, they're messengers. That's what the word angel actually means, is messengers. So they had a message for Lot that he needed to get everyone he had out of town. But they apparently, by asking the question, they seemed to be expressing their ignorance as to whether he had sons or daughters or whatever. They just said, whatever you got, get them out of town. I don't think that Lot had sons. And I think that only because we read about his two virgin daughters, and he had at least two married daughters because he had sons-in-law who had married daughters of his. And yet we don't read of any sons, and therefore I'm assuming he didn't have sons. If he did have sons, they apparently perished in Sodom also, and we don't read of anything about them to tell us of their actual existence. But he simply escaped with his two daughters. His wife almost made it, but not quite. So when Lot, you know, survived that Holocaust of Sodom and Gomorrah, he survived only with two of his daughters. Apparently, at least two daughters and sons-in-law remained in the city, and we don't know if there were other siblings of the children that were there. Any sons, we're not told. So I'm going to have to say I don't think so, but I really don't know because we're not given specific information about that. Okay, Dominique from Salinas is next. Dominique, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I got a question. So I want to know how one activates their faith. And I'm going to tell you why I'm asking this real quick so you understand better.
Okay.
I've been dealing with a lot of pain for a long, long time. For, I don't know, 3 years. My back has bulging disc, and I have two legs that they're paining me constantly. And it's hard to get around, and I wonder, why does God allow such pain in one's life? And, you know, you ask and you ask and you ask for it to be removed. And, you know, I'm a man of faith. I ask God for this or that, and it's like, man, he answers me. But this thing, it's like it's been, 3 years or so, and it's ruining my life, really, because it's just agonizing pain and everything that comes with that. And so, you know, I'm just curious what you think about how one activates their faith like that.
All right. Well, first of all, I'm really sorry to hear about your chronic pain. And by the way, there's a great number of Christians who experience chronic pain. And as you say, it ruins your life in some respects. I mean, it certainly makes your life miserable at a certain level. Although there are people who do manage their pain. I mean, what I mean is they manage it not necessarily in the sense of alleviating it, but they function in spite of it, and it's a challenge to them. It makes life really hard. Whenever I hear about anyone in chronic pain, it grieves me. And I frankly, I've never had chronic pain, so it makes it the more grieving to me that I can't fully relate with what it must be like. And yet, when we talk about activating faith, it sounds as if what you mean by activating faith is activating a faith to be healed. You said you're a man of faith. When you ask God things, they happen. But this is an exception, apparently. And I think maybe what you're thinking of, you may be thinking of faith differently than I am. You're thinking of faith as something that gets a job done. And so when you normally pray in faith, that gets the job done. This is a job that isn't getting done for some reason, even though you're praying and seeking to have faith. I don't see faith as primarily that which gets a job done, although I think it can do that. Faith is a holistic mentality of the believer who puts all confidence in God. And that has several different effects. Not all of them will really change circumstances. Sometimes it does. But if you read in Hebrews chapter 11 about faith and all the people who had faith that we read about there, and again and again you read, by faith they did this. By faith this happened to them. By faith this was their experience. And you'll find as you go through Hebrews 11, there are like four different ways in which faith was manifested in the lives of different people. And one of those ways was that they got delivered out of trouble. That is, God did things for them. Their faith acquired for them relief from persecution, from danger, probably from sickness. They were delivered through fire and through, they stopped the mouths of lions, and they were delivered in battle against their enemies and so forth. These things are listed in Hebrews 11 as what happened to some people because of their faith. But right after that, it lists other people who through faith went through their trials without getting deliverance. In fact, it says they refused deliverance, seeking a better resurrection in some cases. But he says that they were slain by the sword. They were consumed by fire. They were in poverty and persecution, and it gives a long list of things they suffered. And then it says all of these died in faith. Now, that's two of the four things. As you read Hebrews 11, there's some other ways that faith affects people. One is that it gives them an awareness of things in the unseen world that they wouldn't otherwise know, and that transforms your life in a big way. It says in Hebrews 11:1, faith is the evidence of things that are not seen. Okay, so there's an unseen realm that we would not know about except through faith. Faith gives us awareness and the evidence of that unseen realm. God is in that realm. Angels and demons are in that realm. Many things are in that realm, and we'd know nothing about them except for our faith. But you see, as you go through Hebrews 11, it points out that by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by things not that are seen, but are not seen. And it goes on to talk about Moses later in the chapter about how when he had to suffer exile because he was persecuted by the Pharaoh before he actually delivered people from Egypt, it says he endured as one who sees the invisible. In other words, although he didn't see the invisible, his faith made it possible for him to endure the hardship of exile and so forth as if he could see God, who's invisible. Now, people don't see God with their eyes, but by faith, we know he's there because faith is the evidence of the unseen realm. By our faith in him, we live with an awareness of unseen realities that other people don't know about. And Paul, when he was talking about his own trials in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he said that our light affliction works for us a far more enduring and eternal weight of glory. He said, while we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So what Paul actually says is, we actually benefit from our trials by the fact that we can see the unseen, or that we have awareness of the unseen, and that's where we set our focus. Now, that's exactly what Hebrews says faith does. Paul was saying, we have faith. Although we can't see God, we can trust him. And we are suffering. He said that our outward man, in the same passage, that our outward man is perishing, but our inward man is being renewed day by day. Now, the suffering in his body was not being relieved. He says in 2 Corinthians 12 that he had prayed three times for a particular form of physical suffering that he was in to go away, and it didn't go away. And Jesus spoke to him and said, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in your weakness. And so Paul says, I am improved inwardly by my, through my suffering, by my faith when I'm looking at those things that are not seen. So faith isn't necessarily something that you activate to get something to happen. Faith is that which gives you a settled and continuous awareness that there is a realm besides that which you can see. And in that realm, things are going on that are parallel to, but not the same as what's going on in your earthly realm. In this realm, you're suffering. As Paul said, our outward man is perishing, but our inward man is being renewed day by day. And our light afflictions, which are in the physical realm, are working for us an eternal weight of glory. That's the spiritual, unseen realm. So Paul indicates, and the writer of Hebrews indicates, that one of the benefits of faith is that it makes us aware of the unseen realm, and that awareness changes, of course, our whole perspective on things. And whereas if we only knew the seen realm, we'd say, well, what in the world? Why isn't God healing me? There certainly can't be any benefit in me having these chronic pains. But when we see in the unseen realm, we say, oh, God's using these things. These afflictions are working something for me to become more Christ-like. And my faith then gives me that consolation in the midst of it. We also read in Hebrews 11 that people through faith obeyed God. And so there's four ways that faith impacted people in Hebrews 11. One is that it gave them awareness of the unseen realm. Another is that it made them obedient to God. They did, by faith, Noah built an ark when he was told to do it. By faith, Abraham left his homeland when he was told to do it. By faith, these people obeyed God when he told them to do things. So faith makes you obedient to God. It makes you aware of the unseen realm. It can result in relief from physical harms like sickness and so forth. And there were some who experienced such things, according to Hebrews 11. But it also sometimes does not. And many who had just as much faith also perished by the sword and were consumed by the violence of fire and suffered in all the ways that the other group were delivered from. They both had the same kind of faith. It's just that faith isn't a power that you activate like throwing a wall switch that turns on the light and gets power to go through your system. Faith is simply confidence in God. Faith is saying, I know that my Father, God, is a good God. I know that he's sovereign and in charge of everything. And therefore, I know that I will not suffer anything that he cannot make better. He will not make me go through something that he can't turn into something that makes me better in the end if I trust him in it. Now, he can relieve me. I believe that about him too. I also believe that God can heal me. He can deliver me from my trials. And therefore, since he can do that, I have to trust that he would do that if that's what he sees is going to be the very best thing in the long run for me. But the thing that my faith tells me is that I can trust him. I can trust him either to relieve me, if that's the best thing, or to have a very excellent reason for not doing so, if he doesn't do it. It doesn't shake my faith. You see, faith is a settled conviction, a settled persuasion that God is faithful, God is all-powerful, God can be trusted. If you believe that, then your faith is as strong as you could ever wish for it to be. As far as trying to activate it to get God to do something, now see, that's kind of a word of faith position that I don't hold. The word of faith people say that faith is a power which you can activate by positive confessions and get stuff done, get what you want from God, write your own ticket with God, Kenneth Hagin said. I don't believe faith is that way. I don't believe that faith is what's going to heal you if you're going to get healed. It'll be God that's going to heal you. Your role is to trust in God. It's His role to heal you if that's what He thinks is best. And if He does not, I don't think you can go do an end run around what He thinks is best by activating some faith principle. You see, if God wants you healed and you're trusting Him and asking Him and He doesn't heal you, you got to figure, well, there's a reason He's not doing it. But if I'm not satisfied with His reasons, and I decide, well, but if I activate my faith, I can make it happen anyway. See, we're looking at faith as something that works independently of God then, and possibly at cross purposes with God. It's something like a tool that we have to get our way when God isn't giving us our way. And I don't think faith in the Bible is ever represented that way. Faith is our confidence and our link toward God through our conviction that He is on the throne, that He is all-powerful, and He's our Father, and He's on our side, and He has only our best in mind for us, and we can count on Him. Now, I can't tell you the best way to function in the midst of your chronic pain. I do think that God can heal, and I've known of God to heal people with chronic pain. I've also known of people who were not healed, and God used them and even glorified Himself in their lives despite their continuing pain. I honestly don't know what God will be calling you to do in this respect, but I would say there may be some help for you in a series of lectures at our website. They're practical, and it's called Making Sense Out of Suffering. And basically, these lectures are not just philosophical, these or just theological. These lectures biblically teach how to benefit from suffering in a biblical manner, and how to understand it and how to make sense of it. It may be of use to you to listen to those lectures. And for anyone who wants to hear those lectures, they're free, of course. Everything at our website is free. The website is thenarrowpath.com, just like the name of the radio program, thenarrowpath.com. And there's a link there that says topical lectures, and you'd look for the series that's called Making Sense Out of Suffering. It's only four lectures, but certainly I think would be able to address the questions you're asking, Dominic, in a way more comprehensively than I'm able to do here on the air with calls waiting. I do appreciate your call, brother. Let's talk to Walt from Kaiser, Oregon. Walt, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. My two questions are from 1 Samuel. The first one is from chapter 2, verse 1. The use of the word horn in my translation, Hannah says, "My horn is exalted in the Lord." What exactly does that mean?
Okay, usually in poetry, and this is a poem she uttered, in Hebrew poetry, a horn usually refers to power. David often speaks about God elevating his horn. In fact, in some of the visions of Daniel, the beasts that represent different empires have different numbers of horns, which represent power centers or kings or whatever. For example, a ram that has two horns, one more considerable than the other. One of those horns represents the Persian power, and one the Median power that were joined together in the Media-Persian Empire. Horns usually have to do with power, and it may well be that what Hannah is saying is, I was powerless and humiliated in my powerlessness, because she was childless, and her husband had another wife that had children, and that other wife who had children mocked her for her barrenness, and she was powerless in the face of such mockery to vindicate herself in any way. And whereas God now had given her a child, and she felt vindicated, God has raised her up despite her powerlessness. Her horn has been exalted. And she might even be thinking of in her rivalry against the other wife of her husband. I'm not sure. But the point here seems to be that she's been empowered in that particular area where she was totally helpless and disempowered before. Now, another alternative I've read from some commentators is that since a horn is referring to the imagery of an animal that has horns, something like a ram or a deer or something that has horn, a bull that has horns, that the raising up of the horn corresponds with the raising up of the head. And you know that David in Psalm 3 talked about how God is the lifter up of his head. And it's possible to say that the raising up of the horn, my horn, God has lifted up my horn, could be simply saying God has raised my head up. I was dejected, in other words. My head was hanging down. I was dejected, but my head has been lifted up. It's like God has put his hand under my chin and pulled it, pulled my face up to be more, you know, encouraged or whatever. And the horn, picturing it as if it's an animal with horns, like a sheep. The shepherd lifting the sheep's face up causes its horns to be raised. I haven't felt that that is the likely meaning, but I encountered it fairly recently. And although I've been, of course, reading commentaries for years, I don't think I'd heard this particular expression of it until very recently. But I throw it in there since it is something that some people would say.
Well, thank you, Steve. That's very good. I have one more simple question, I think, from chapter 18, verse 10.
Okay.
It says that Saul was given a distressing spirit from the Lord, and he prophesied. That seems rather odd to me that God would prophesy through him in that circumstance when he was being distressed because he was angry with David and wanted to kill him, and somehow the Lord gave him a distressing spirit, and then he prophesied. I'm curious about that.
Well, you're using, I'm sure, the New King James, which uses the expression, a distressing spirit. In the Hebrew, which is actually followed more closely by the King James, it says an evil spirit. It says an evil spirit from the Lord came to Saul, and he prophesied. Now, an evil spirit is that expression in the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, is the same as in the Greek of the New Testament. It talks about people having evil spirits. In other words, a demon is an evil spirit. And we read in a few places in the Old Testament that God sent these evil spirits against certain persons that were under his judgment. Now, an evil spirit often influences the speech of the person who's possessed by the Spirit. Just like a person who's filled with the Holy Spirit, he speaks through them. Like on the day of Pentecost, when people were filled with the Holy Spirit, it says they spoke in tongues and they prophesied. It said, quoting Joel, you know, your sons and daughters will prophesy. To prophesy means to speak under the influence of a spirit. And of course, the true prophet spoke under the influence of God's Spirit. But there were people who were demon-possessed who spoke under the influence of evil spirits. In fact, 1 John 4, I think, is referring to this phenomenon. In 1 John 4, 1, when it says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out in the world." Now, the spirits here would speak of the spirits speaking through people. And he said there are not all the spirits that speak through people are good spirits. We need to test the spirits because there's false prophets as well as true prophets. So a person can be a prophet if can be prophesying through the power of the Holy Spirit, or they can be prophesying through the influence of an evil spirit. I think that was the case with Saul. You find it in 1 Kings 22 also, when that famous story about how King Ahab wanted to go to war at Ramoth-Gilead, and his prophets, his staff prophets, were saying, "Go, you'll prosper." But then when the prophet Micaiah was brought in, who was a true prophet of God, he says, "You know, I'll tell you why your prophets are saying go and prosper. I saw a vision, and God was wanting to have you die at Ramoth-Gilead." And he was consulting all the spirits, apparently in the universe, saying, "Who will go and make Ahab fall at Ramoth-Gilead?" And an evil spirit came up and said, "I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets." And God said, "Okay, go and do that." So this evil spirit had come to be in the mouth of the prophets, and they were prophesying evil. They were prophesying falsely they were saying, "Hey, if he goes to Ramoth-Gilead, he'll prosper there, that he'll survive." But actually, he was going to go there and die. So In other words, when a person speaks under the power of an evil spirit, and in that case, too, it was also an evil spirit from the Lord, that God sanctioned this evil spirit to prophesy through these false prophets to deceive Ahab. Well, the result is prophesying. And I think when it says that an evil spirit came on Saul and he prophesied, we'd have to assume that he didn't prophesy, you know, true prophecies. He prophesied like these evil spirits prophesy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a wise man, Steve. You've given me some good, makes a lot of sense.
Well, coming from you, that's truly a compliment, because I have great respect for you.
Well, thanks, Steve.
All right. God bless you, Walt.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. One reason I said I have great respect for Walt is he and his wife, whom he lost only a few months ago. She died recently, but as you can tell from his voice, he's an older man, and he and his wife spent many years as missionaries in Africa. And I only met him only after he came back from the mission field, but he's done some writing and so forth, and I've read things he's written. And so I actually do hold you in respect, Walt, and appreciate the fact that you like this program. Let's talk to Lawrence from Las Vegas, Nevada. Lawrence, welcome.
Hello. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm well. Thank you.
And, my question is also is in 1 Samuel, I believe, chapter 3, verse 19. Mm-hmm. And basically speaking about how Eli was to be punished by God because of what his sons have done. And the vision was given to Samuel. But reading here in 19, it says Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And I guess my question will be based on, can we change God's mind?
By, you mean praying?
Yes, I guess in prayer can we change God's mind?
Okay, coming from that particular verse you quoted, I'm going to assume that what you mean is Samuel said things and God honored that and didn't let those words fall to the ground. Therefore, what Samuel predicted seemed to dictate God's behavior. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. You worded it better than me. Thank you.
Well, I'm thinking, I was trying to figure out how that particular line led to that particular question, but it makes sense to me now. So it sounds like Samuel the prophet would prophesy something, and God didn't let his words fail to come true, which suggests that it was Samuel's prophesying it that determined whether God was going to do something or not, and God honored Samuel by making it happen. That's, you know, I don't think we're to read that into it, though. I can certainly see that sounding that way. As I understand it, prophets did not determine things by their predictions, but they only foresaw things that God showed them. The things that they foresaw were already determined by God. Now, I don't believe, as some people do, that all things are determined by God, predetermined by God, but I do believe some things are. I mean, God has plans, and he works his plans. And it says in the book of Amos, surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. So God, when he's going to do something, will reveal it, and the prophets will foresee it because by divine revelation, and they'll speak it. And I believe that was true of Samuel. Although this verse, the way it's worded, might not seemingly, seem most naturally understood that way. I think that is the phenomenon that was going on there. And the wording could simply be arguing that, God never allowed Samuel to prophesy falsely. And God always told him what was really going to happen so that Samuel's words, once spoken, never failed to come true. Not because Samuel was determining what would happen and God, you know, responding and making it happen, but rather because God raised him up in an age where there were false prophets and gave him accurate predictions so that his words never fell to the ground. That is, his words never failed to come true. The short answer is, no, I don't think that Samuel changed God's mind about things. Now, as far as whether intercessory prayer can change God's mind about something, that's an interesting question. Some people would say yes and some say no. The ones who would say no are those who believe that everything has already been predetermined by God, and therefore, of course, nothing we do can make it change. And therefore, when God appears to change course or appears to do something in response to our request, it's simply to be understood that he foreordained that change and foreordained that we would make that request. He foreordained that we would pray that way and that he would make that change, so that he didn't really change because we said it. It's more we said it because he ordained that we would say it, because he was going to do that change anyway. To me, that makes it sound like God's playing a game to make things appear to be happening that aren't. And I honestly don't think the Bible supports that view of things. I think that there are some things that God leaves to us and some things he does not. I think C.S. Lewis put it like this. He said, it's like if somebody wrote a play and the author of the play only wrote the broad plot and main turning points of the play, but he left it up to the actors to improvise a lot of the parts. The play was pretty much going to go the way the author wants it to, but some things were in the power of the participants, the actors, to determine. They don't have the kind of power that would change the play entirely, because they have to conform to the contours that the author has prearranged, but they have some wiggle room there. And there are, I believe, major movements in history that God has predetermined that it's just not going to happen any other way. He's got it laid out. But he does have certain things where he will act if we pray, and he won't act if we don't. We know that because James said, you have not because you ask not. And that word, that expression can't mean anything unless it means God would have done something if you'd asked him, but you didn't ask him, so he didn't. So it was pretty much left to your discretion to pray or not to pray. And we do see cases in the Bible where God is planning to do a certain thing, but he changes it because someone asks him, someone intercedes for them. And, again, someone who has a worldview that sees God as predetermining everything would say, well, God just predetermined the prayers and the intercession, just like he predetermined the change, of course, which is, a possibility, but I don't see it as the most natural way to read the scriptures about those things.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate your knowledge. Thank you very much. So God bless you.
All right, Lawrence. Thanks for your call, brother. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, I was going to take another call. We do have other callers online here, but it is time, actually, about 2 seconds. We're going to hear the music play. Oh, there it is. And that means the show is essentially over. And we will not be able to take any more calls until tomorrow. The Narrow Path radio broadcast you're listening to right now is on daily from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, Monday through Friday. And therefore, the calls that don't get in on one day, if the Lord tarries if we live, we will be able to do it another day. Now, there's two things. I said if the Lord tarries and if we live. There's nothing is if we can pay for the radio time. And that's something that is one of those factors that determines whether we keep on the air or not. We buy time. Most of the programs you listen to on Christian radio are doing the same thing. They're buying time. When they say, hey, we are listener supported, what it means is they need money to come in so they can buy the radio time. One difference in our case is we don't have any expenses except buying radio time, pretty much. We don't have any office. We don't have any secretaries. We don't have any staff. There's no one paid anything here. This is all volunteer work, including me. And therefore, whatever is donated is simply donated to buy radio time and make the show available to more people. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. There's a link there for donating there too as well, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you.